Hey, this is Adam and Ben popping in real quick to tell you thanks. Thank you for all of your support during the Max Fund Drive. Support you've directed to the greatest discovery. It's thanks to that support, we're able to tell you that we will be able to make this show for another year.
Yeah, we really, really appreciate it. The outpouring of support for this show is really breathtaking, given that it's the smallest show we do audience size-wise of our three. You guys really came through in a huge way, and it is for that reason that we can sustain this thing. So, thank you.
Captain! Captain! Signatures detected!
Shield up!
Signatures detected!
Red alert!
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison, breaking NDAs.
I like how we're going metronomic with the show open here, Ben, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah, no, we're not actually going to break an NDA, but we wanted to talk about that. We mentioned it, is it two episodes ago?
I think at this moment in time it is, yeah.
Yeah, we were going kind of incognito into the pocket to check out something W/R/T Star Trek Discovery, and we got some guidelines about how we could talk about it and what about it we could say. So we thought we would peel back the kimono.
It's a real Catherine Zeta-Jones in the movie Entrapment kind of wiggling around the NDA stipulations in order to talk about this.
We've put on our terry cloth cat suits and we're gonna do our best not to violate anything we signed.
I think what we can say starts out like a good friend of DeSoto reached out to us and mentioned that he has a very interesting job on the Warner Brothers lot.
Yeah, so Adam, you were gonna be in Southern California already for another thing.
Right.
And this FOD, Richard, reached out and was like, hey, I worked the recording sessions for the orchestral score on Star Trek Discovery, and I can get you into one of them.
I love, like, let me just say something about Richard throughout. He downplayed so hard how cool he thought this would be to us.
I know.
He's like, yeah, I mean, if you don't have anything going on or whatever, like, this is something that I can make available for you. But really, like, if you are busy, do not worry about taking me up on this. And back channel wise, me and Ben are like, holy shit! We gotta go do this! How do we do this?
Yeah, I'm always scared to go do things by myself, so I was really glad that you were going to be... Like, I don't think I would have passed this up, but I was scared...
Oh, I hope not.
I was scared to do it alone, and I was really glad you were going to be in Southern California to do it with me.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
It felt good to have a socializing buddy.
Yeah.
So we went out to... They do this on the Warner Brothers lot. Surprisingly enough.
Which is the Pee-wee's Big Adventure lot. It looked so familiar.
Yeah.
I had never been on this lot before, so it was kind of magical.
Yeah, it was really cool. We like parked and like we got, over the course of a day that we spent there, we spent some time just like walking around the lot, and there's like the New York subway station portion of the lot, and like they can kind of make it look like DC or New York or small town USA, like depending on which direction you point the camera. It's really cool. And every studio building, the big sound stages that you see in all those shots in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, like they have signs up on the walls of like which movies and television shows were shot there. And that's also just like a really fun, like,
yeah,
just feeling like the history of that, like, oh man, like they shot movies in like the 60s in some of these buildings.
Yeah, you could really feel the magic of the place, even though like outside of the scoring session, it didn't feel like a beehive of activity. Like even with the soundstage doors open, when you walk past one, it didn't seem to be a very in production day.
Yeah. It seemed like maybe Conan was in production because Conan O'Brien's set is there. Ellen's set is there. And we saw like people lining up for to be like studio audiences a couple of times. We also saw Sonequa Martin Green like hanging out on a park bench taking a phone call, which was thrilling.
She was, we heard later, there to do ADR work. But like we rounded a corner and you and I are just chatting and we see her on a park bench. And honestly, my heart just stopped when I saw her because like I never expected that she of all people would be someone that we ran into on that lot.
Yeah. Cause you know, you're conscious of the fact that they shoot the show in Toronto.
Yeah.
And like, and why would she be like, she like couldn't like, they could record ADR anywhere. Like she could be going in and looping that stuff in Toronto or anywhere in LA. Like there's no reason for it to specifically be that lot, but it just is.
And the idea that the one star sighting that we saw while we were there was her was really special.
Yeah. She's, it really caught my heart too. It was like, it was stunning to see her in person. I wish she hadn't been on the phone. I would have gone up and said what a big fan I was.
See, that's different. We are very different in that way. And like, you are the same guy who said he wouldn't want to go to this opportunity alone. I'm the guy that I'm so reluctant to just walk up to people the way you are. So I'm glad that if that were to happen, you would have spearheaded that effort because I'm not that way.
You know, if Robs would have been there, he would have gone up to her and said, hey, can you put down the phone for a second and read into this recording device? Hi, I'm Sonequa Martin Green, and you're listening to The Greatest Generation on MaximumFun.org.
I think that's why I love Robs, is that he's willing to do that. He has a strength that I do not.
Yeah, he really does.
For that kind of thing. She is so beautiful in person.
Yeah.
I was really gobsmacked by her.
You could like feel her before we even walked around the corner.
yeah and like, yeah, it's really hard to put into words what that was like.
It was crazy.
It was great. Yeah,
but
I want to believe that she smiled at me while she was on the phone, Ben.
Yeah, but she was probably just smiling at something somebody said on the phone.
Probably.
She would never smile at you, Adam.
Why do you gotta be like that, man? Let me have this.
Okay, she smiled at you. But let's talk about this recording session. This was so cool.
Yeah.
So they were recording music for an episode of the show, and I don't think we can be specific about which episode it was. We didn't read the NDA. And we asked...
Because we signed two of them, and both of them were 6 pages long.
Yeah. So we asked what we can say and what we, and can't say, and we're going to do our best to do right by them. But I think what's cool is that we got to see like the condition the show is in when they record the music for it. So it's like edited, but it's not done, you know?
Right. A lot of these special effects are placeholder effects. So what you would see on screen are the people from the show, but they're playing against often unfinished comps. So you'll see some green screen or some effects that are unfinished when it comes to like exterior shots.
It really brought out for me how much work goes into this show. Like what an achievement it is in terms of its visual style. Like it is so stylish and cohesive in a very specific way.
Yeah.
And what they've achieved with that is really cool. And like they had a whole, like a, probably like a 40 piece orchestra, right? Playing music along to it.
I've played in concert bands in high school, and like there is nothing comparable between that and what we saw in that studio. Like the way these sessions work is like the orchestra plays to the visual on the screen,
and then they're
tweaking it for taste. Like give me a little more of this, give me a little more of that, until they get the feeling right, and then they move on. And what was so amazing was that a note could come in to change the way that something was played.
Yeah.
And it was...
like, this is the first time this orchestra has ever seen this music. And they're just playing it by sight reading it and playing it amazingly. And also, like, the level of perfectionism, like, what what the composer and the team are looking for in terms of the performance, like, is incredibly specific, and they're willing to go back three times to get it in a way where, like, when the, like, they would do take one and I'd be like, that was great. And then they would, like, give notes and they would change it. I'd be like, oh my God, that was even better. Holy shit.
Yeah. It always got better with every take.
It was amazing. It was so cool.
Like, I really like the relationship between Jeff Russo and the orchestra, too. Like, it felt, hey, let's do it this way this time. And then they would take the note and then they would move on. Like, it felt like the vibe was good and positive. And I've played in bands before where it is not like that.
Yeah, it was really cool. Like, it was very collaborative, like, really good spirits. It seemed like they really like working together and liked working on this. And
when you play in a band for 8-hour shifts, like, that's not something that I was expecting to see. Like, I think we got in there at hour 3 of what was going to be an 8-hour day. And, like, people were buoyant. It felt like a good vibe.
It was really cool.
And we were, like, welcomed there. I was expecting a little more, like, who the hell are these guys type of vibe. But I never felt that once. It felt, like, very welcoming to strangers.
It was such a cool thing to see. And just, like, what a cool thing to have be your job, you know? Like, oh, yeah, like, here's some guys that are visiting us at work today. And what work is we sit in a room and we play a beautiful score for the first time and the last time, and we do it at a super high level.
Classic Richard at the end is like, boy, I can't believe you guys stuck around for that long. Like, hope we didn't bore you too much.
I know.
No, Rich. It was great. I promise.
It was fucking amazing. He also gave us 2 6-packs of beer from his hometown.
Wow. Just awesome.
Yeah.
During a dinner break, we got to meet Jeff Russo briefly and tell him how much his work meant to us. And hopefully he didn't think it was too weird of a thing to meet a couple of nerdy podcasters. But because he's a cool-ass guy. He was a founding member of the band Tonic. Like, he's a fucking rock star.
Yeah.
So couldn't be more gracious to both of us.
It was really, really cool to see. And thank you to Richard for setting it up. I hope we didn't say something that gets you in trouble.
Hope so, too. I hope he was being honest when he said we could come back anytime, because it's really something I would like to do again. That was special.
Yeah, that was great. Well, Adam, what do you say we get into Season 2, Episode 11, Perpetual Infinity?
Let's do it, Ben. You ever get a watch with Perpetual Infinity? Ben, they sell those at jewelry stores that I can't afford to even walk inside.
Yeah, they see you coming down the street and they say, not this one, bub.
Yeah. You know, you may not use our bathroom.
We know about you. So this episode starts in flashback.
Yeah.
Then we should celebrate.
Yes, we should.
We've had very brief stuff with young Burnham over the course of this season, but I really like her. I think they did a great job of getting her to a place where her performance feels plausibly similar to Sonequa Martin-Green's, like, character-wise.
Yeah, I agree. It helps that she's a good actor, to be honest. Like, that's what it boils down to me. If she sucked, I think she would crater these scenes, but she's not. She's filled with that, like, precociousness of youthful intelligence that can sometimes cut towards annoying, but just isn't. You get this family unit scene here of the doctor and Mr. Burnham and their daughter and Michael, and I mean, it's nice.
I think they're both doctors.
Okay. Well, I was trying to distinguish them, because as we go on talking about them, it could get a little confusing. Did you know that the mister, that the husband, was played by Kenrick Green, who is Sonequa Martin Green's husband in real life?
No shit.
Yeah.
Did they bring him in for the purposes of it would be fun to have somebody in her family be playing someone in her family? Or is he, like, also a working actor?
I have the chills from that cold-ass shade.
God damn it.
No, man, he's got plenty of credits. He's got
I've never seen him before, to my knowledge.
No, I haven't either. Like, here's the thing, his credits are, like, he's got credits, but he's got a bunch of short films and like, TV appearances, but he's not a regular on anything but The Walking Dead.
That's where she was from too, right? She was on that show?
Yeah.
Did they meet on that show?
I mean, I have to believe that because he was on the series from 2015 to 2019, and in 22 episodes, you sort of, you know, like when you shoot a TV series, you, I think you choose a series husband and a series wife. Like, this is something mm-hmm. in my time visiting professional TV and movie sets, like, you see this happen. People pair off, and often it just lasts for the life of the show, but sometimes it works out in the forever kind of way, and that's what happened with Kenrick and Sonequa Martin-Green.
Wow.
They made it work.
That's what gave us Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it doesn't work all the time.
Well, worked long enough for them to be a family for a little while.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Sonequa Martin-Green is going to divorce this guy.
Why are you saying that Kenrick Green is not a real actor? That's what I'm wondering. Like, kind of a weird thing to put in the ground here.
They all live in the Athleisure Dome, which apparently is a planet that they are the only people on, because they, you know, it's kind of Michael Burnham's mom finishing up science while Michael and her dad set the table, and then the Klingons show up, and Michael Burnham gets shoved in the closet, where, you know, we've seen many flashbacks from the perspective of inside that closet. But this flashback then follows the mom as she gets in the Red Angel suit. She uses one of those, like, Velcro hand paddles that you see people playing with a tennis ball on the beach, and gets the time crystal, puts it in the back of the suit, hops in, and jumps in time before the Klingon blasts can hit her.
Her interest at this point is going back in time to save them.
She's imagining that she's going to show up 1 hour previous to warn everybody of what's going to happen.
Right.
I liked that the house had red alert.
Yeah.
I feel like my house needs that.
I like that. That's, you know,
your house definitely needs that.
You see a lot of, like, modern, like the simply safeification of homes right now that offer, like, the siren if should a window be opened without your permission, but they're not giving you the lights. Give me the lights, I think.
Yeah.
To complete the set.
I want strips of red LEDs impregnated in almost everything that will go off in unison when something befalls my house.
This is a set dressing that you only see in a perfect future, Ben, because there's a variety of juices on the table for this scene that is a hotel brunchian amount, you know? Like, there's a number of juices that you never get in real life.
Right. We can't invest in this much juice because it's just all sugar, you know? and we're not going to honestly finish all this juice before it goes bad.
I feel like if I were invited over to your home for breakfast and there were more than one juice on the table, it would be all I could talk about. Like, it's such a weird, it's like
Cran apple and orange? What?
Way to throw it in my face, Ben.
You're so fancy.
It's like the house that has more than two types of glasses, you know?
Yeah.
Like, whoa.
I've got an orange juice glass and a different shaped Cran apple glass, and I'm putting them in front of you, and I'm saying, like, yeah, I realized that the shape of the glass really affects the flavor when I was going to my tennis academy.
For my entire life, I've only known two types of glasses, tall and short. And now that I'm a little bit older and married, we've introduced things like wine as a third glass.
Last year for my wife's birthday, I introduced a second type of wine glass.
Oh, shit.
Because we had ones that were red wine oriented, and I got her some white wine oriented ones.
Yeah, so it begins.
Yep. The complexification of glassware is, I mean, it's insane, right? Because we have a very small kitchen that does not have, like, for whatever reason, when our landlord redid the apartment we live in, they did not elect to put any overhead cabinets in. So we have exclusively under-counter cabinetry.
Mm.
There's nowhere to put these glasses.
That'll be better when the big one hits. Shout out to one of our favorite podcast compulsions lately, The Big One.
Yeah, shout out to my next door neighbor who was the executive producer of The Big One, a great podcast about earthquake preparedness. Yeah.
All those glasses, like tears in rain.
Yeah, yeah. I asked her like what I needed to do to get ready for the big one, and she was like, "Oh, we got you. Like when it hits, like the wall between our units will fall down, and we've got everything."
Nice neighbors you got there.
I know. I felt very safe.
So Michael Burnham comes to in Six Bay, and it's Dr. Culber back in uniform.
Back in white. 10 makeouts with Stamets be far behind when Dr. Culber is back in the white uniform.
But maybe it shouldn't be so simple.
I think the white uniform doesn't do much for his jackedness, you know? Because we know the secret now. We know what's under that uniform, and it is lumpy.
We know that he is Terra phone book and half built.
Yeah. Why cover that up? Tear the sleeves off like that scientist on Regular One, Doc.
Yeah, yeah. Or Mirror Universe Kirk.
Yeah.
Show them off. Shake what your mama gave you.
This is a scene that is one of a couple in this episode that is a showcase for Sonequa Martin-Green's ability as an actor.
Because I love this scene.
Because in this scene, she gets the news about her mom. And she gets 3 runs at the line, "She died." And she takes such different goes at that line all 3 times that it feels impossible. Like, I'm not an actor, obviously, but when I think about how I would perform those lines, there's no way I could get to the place that she gets to here. It's incredible.
No, she died. She died. She died.
There's the joke about actors that they're always saying their lines in slightly different tone of voice, trying right. to find the thing. And and instead, this is her saying 3 entirely different statements that are made up of the exact same string of words.
Yeah. You aren't supposed to be able to win this game 3 times, and she wins 3 times.
And with 3 different strategies.
I want to say this right now. I don't want this to be an insult to the show, but I think Sonequa Martin-Green's work is better than this show. Like, she is now starting to, like, rise above the material in a way that, like, distinguishes her from everyone else. And again, like, that's going to sound like shade on the other actors or on the show itself, but I don't mean it that way. I think she's just fucking crushing this right now. Yeah. Like, she's really coming into it in season 2.
She's hella good.
Yeah.
What they tell her, like, it doesn't make a lot of sense initially because the opinion that Dr. Culber said very forcefully was that this Red Angel was Michael Burnham. And we speculated that there was something about, like, genetically or whatever similar about them. Last episode, we got an email in the drunkshimoda@gmail.com box from friend of DeSoto, Christy Ono, who she emailed us a UCSF brain study that shows that, like, the brain structure governing emotion is directly passed down from mother to daughter.
And wow.
It seems like pretty, like, well-established real science that they're talking about in this scene when they talk about, like, mitochondrial DNA. I know that that's something that, like, they, you know, like, the Y chromosome is a way that they can, like, study male lineage because, like, you get your Y chromosome from your dad mm-hmm. and he got it from his dad on into the past. And I think mitochondrial DNA is matrilineally inherited in almost exactly the same way. So pretty interesting, like, use of contemporary new science. Like, this is a 2016 study.
Wow.
I love it when Star Trek does shit like this.
I love it when we occasionally check our drunkshimoda@gmail.com inbox.
Yeah. Christy Ono is a comedian in San Francisco, and she said she has a chunk about that study in her set.
Wow. I hope it kills.
So if you're in the Bay Area, keep an eye out for Christy Ono performances.
So Michael Burnham is super broken up at being prevented from seeing her mother. But to soften the blow, she's given a pad of 841 mission logs.
And she's like, ooh, that's a lot of mission logs. You got any like Trex in the City or Mamre Alpha or anything else to break it up in that iPad?
Is 841 episodes actually, I wonder if that's how many episodes Mission Log has.
Oh, I don't know.
God, what if this show were sending
it's
that message?
It's just trolling us.
Yeah.
These guys aren't too edgy.
I've got 289. That can't be true, right?
No, I mean, because they started with TOS and now they're on Deep Space Nine. So that seems fair.
Mm. So we cut to Leland, who is in some restraints talking to Control. Control having taken the holographic form of a couple of different people in order to communicate to him.
And taken on the kinks of Section 31.
Right. Control is making the case for the inevitability of its agenda, but in doing that is kind of admitting the limitation of its methods because Control needs a body, and Leland has one.
This is a fun scene because it kind of makes Leland like the best guy before turning him into the villain of the series. I like the idea that he went down like, you know, declaring his allegiance to the good team, even though he's been kind of a gray area character up until now.
Yeah.
But Control has a clip show drone that it hooks up to the back of Leland's head and starts injecting him with little itty bitty nanorobots.
Feels a little Borgsy, yeah?
It does, yeah.
Even the struggle is pointless comment feels a little like proto-Borg. Like, it feels a little Resistance is Futile adjacent, like a first draft of Resistance is Futile.
I wonder if that's where they're headed with this. Like,
I really hope not, man.
Yeah.
Don't let it be that.
You know what I heard? This show is a show that likes to borrow from other Star Trek series to, you know, to draw threads between itself and older Trek. I mean, I think that could be something that they're going to go for here. Like, this is Control is like, it's like shot into the other side of the galaxy and then turns into Borgs or something like that. But I was talking to a friend who had it on good authority that they are casting for young Picard right now in Los Angeles. He has a friend who's an actor and was asked to audition for young Picard.
Whoa, actually auditioned for it.
Yeah. So we were talking about like whether that could be for Disco or the Picard series, but unclear at this point.
We get a scream into commercial, Ben, that makes me ask you this question. How many times in TNG or DS9 did we get a character screaming as loud as they could? Because that is a thing about Star Trek Discovery, whether it's Agony Booth.
It's usually when Klingons die is pretty much it.
Yeah, it's Agony Booth or it's Michael Burnham being suffocated or whatever. I bet, like, over under, how many times has someone screamed for their life on Star Trek Discovery? I want to say 10.
Yeah. A lot.
A lot. You know one of my favorite things to do, W/R/T making jokes on this show, Ben, is the creation of a portmanteau.
Mm.
What we've seen, what we've witnessed before the theme is the creation of Contreeland. I'm just going to give you that gift.
Thank you?
Where do I return this awful portmanteau?
So Burnham, her job for the next little while is just watch the video logs of her mom as she reports back from the future. Because she did not go an hour into the past. She went 950 years into the future and is kind of stuck there. Like, she can make she can bounce into other times, but the visits are brief because she's always brought back to this future time period.
You ever try to reset the clock on your stove when the power goes out and it only goes one way, so you got to hold it so that the time goes faster to come around to the other side? I feel like that's...
And if you overshoot, you're just stuck doing it all the way through again.
I can see how difficult it would be to go, like, to intend to go a year in the past and instead go 950 years into the future if what she's using is, like, stove clock technology.
I mean, everything else she has is so advanced, though.
Yeah, yeah.
My current stove has an analog clock, and to change the time, you just turn the knob, and it's incredibly quick. It's like, this is so much better. The fucking digitalization of this thing was a step backwards.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be that hard.
I wondered what she's eating 950 years in the future, because they say, like, all organic life has been eliminated.
It looks like she set up a little Dagobah camp. You know, like an encampment.
Right. And then she says, like, she moved to Terralysium where she saved all these people, and, like, Control can't find her because there's no technology.
Yeah.
So is Terralysium fine in this future?
How badly did Pike fuck that up by giving them technology then, you know? Whoops-a-doodle. Our friends back there think they have the ability to turn on the lights in their church. What they've done is set off a beacon to be annihilated by Control.
Yeah. So sad, too bad, as Jackie Cation says.
Yeah. We get a ton of elliptical information from these logs throughout the episode.
Basically, what is set up is that Michael Burnham's mom, Dr. Gabrielle Burnham, has been sort of a one-woman anti-control machine. Mm. And she has been going through the timeline, trying everything she can to stop Control from getting access to the sphere data, the archive of information that they got off that sphere early in the season, is the thing that Control wants and needs to evolve itself into the sinister future robot intelligence that it wants to be.
Right. And because a running clock increases tension, what's happening at this exact moment is, like, the pull on the suit that occurs after every time jump is increasing. So the longer that Dr. Burnham and the suit remain in this, like, fixed in this time, the stronger the universe's pull is to fling it back 950 years into the future.
Right. So, there's some fun stuff with how they have to kind of max everything out with the containment field they have set up on the planet to keep her there. We have a pretty fun scene with her and Pike where she's basically super pissed about having had this trap sprung on her. And this is a great, like, exposition scene because Pike is like, okay, well, all we want to do is, like, stop Control and do the thing. Like, we are on the same team. Like, just tell us what to do. Like, let's be teammates here. And the idea that she suggests is wipe the archive. Like, zero out the disk that is on, and that's the prize that Control is seeking. If that's not there anymore, then Control doesn't won't be able to access it.
And what they're talking about is the hard format, not just the quick one that doesn't.
The one
really...
where it, like, rewrites zeros over the entire disk.
The one that takes hours and hours.
I have faith in Discovery's crew.
On the Section 31 ship, Contreland is proposing a new strategy. He wants to intercept this sphere data, and he's trying to get Ash and Georgiou to go along. But what's funny about this scene is that Ash and Georgiou are looking at each other like, why is Leland getting so much dialogue this episode? Like, this is more than he's ever said ever. And, like, that's the thing that betrays what's going on, I feel like. Ordinarily, Leland would be a little bit squishy in his orders, or he won't order Ash and Georgiou as hardly as he's doing right here. And so it's less that his confidence is out of character and more that his amount of dialogue is. Not very subtle.
Yeah, it's not very subtle, and even Georgiou makes comments on it, like, like, what crawled up your ass? Like, yeah, you're telling us a specific thing to do.
Yeah.
They have a McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
On the disco that Ash Tyler is there for, because he's been given the order to, like, go steal the thumb drive that the Sphere Archive is on and get it into the Control. So fucking annoying that they call this thing Control.
I know. It's impossible to talk about.
It's like when you're learning to drive and you ask a question and your dad says, right, and you turn right. And he's like, I mean, correct.
Perfect.
Yeah. You know, Section 31 wants the archive in their custody. And Ash Tyler's been sent to do that. But this McLaughlin group is them deciding that Gabrielle is probably right. And even though it is kind of a tragic loss to science and discovery, they should probably just wipe the disk. Saru compares this to burning the library at Alexandria. And yet, when given the order by Pike, he's like, all right, I'm going to do it.
Is that a real fish tank back there, or is that a screensaver? Do we know?
Looks like there's toasters flying out that window.
So you're on the side of screensaver then.
You're talking about the ball on the screen?
I'm talking about in the background of this McLaughlin group, one of the screens looks like a water scene with a fish in it.
Really?
And it's either a projection on a screen or it's an actual fish tank there.
Shit, I missed that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not unprecedented for there to be a fish tank in a captain's ready room, and that's kind of where this is taking place, right?
Right, right. Dr. Burnham is waking up, and she wants to see Pike and not Michael, and this is very upsetting to Michael. But this is the part of the episode where Pike has to tell Michael that she gets to watch the feed. And nothing good happens on the feed, as we've learned.
The other person watching the feed of all the GoPro mission logs that Dr. Burnham has made is Spock. And he finds a video of her explaining why Spock was of such a utility to her. He has a Vulcan, you know, combination Vulcan-human psyche that makes him kind of like emotionally vulnerable enough, but also logically sound enough to communicate with her through the suit. But also he has dyslexia, and that gives him the ability to kind of cope with the confusing aspect of the time, you know, disturbances around her.
It's some real faint praise, because in the log, Dr. Burnham's like, yeah, all of these problems that Spock has are really the reason that I seeked him out.
Yeah.
Which was great for me. His fucked up mind is the only thing that can understand what's happening here.
This scene, I had some resonance with this scene. Because yeah? one of the things I have been working on in therapy is the idea of not hating myself for my shortcomings.
Mm.
You know? And Michael Burnham says, like, you know, like that your dyslexia wound up being a strength in this case. And I don't personally have dyslexia, but I have a lot of shortcomings and I have a hard time not hating myself because of them. And I think that's a good message. And I liked that it was in this episode.
Yeah, man.
It's a good thing to unburden yourself of like self-judgment for shit that isn't really under your control, you know?
If you ever figure that out, let me know.
Takes practice.
One thing that the lady who sticks needles into me told me related to that concept was when I was telling her about...
I don't want to hear about your dominatrix, Adam.
I was expressing a feeling a lot like that to her, and she said it would help if you made that thing something else and not you. Like, if you could turn your doubt and your self-hate into a thing that is not you and is instead like something separate from you, It would help you fight it, because you do not want to fight yourself as hard as you would ever fight something that was not yourself. You know what I mean?
It's kind of like in like season 5, I think, of The Real Housewives of Atlanta. It seems like Nene Leakes has been in therapy for a little while at this point, and she starts referring to like the version of her that comes out when she loses her temper as Nene. It's like that.
That's why I named this version of me Nene. All roads lead back to Real Housewives, don't they?
All roads.
arrived, honey. I have arrived.
But in this scene with Spock, Michael Burnham comes in and she makes the case for, like, I really need to talk to this lady, my mom. He really agrees.
My mom.
Yeah, that famous Borat line. My mom.
As great as Sonequa Martin-Green is in this episode, that was a questionable choice.
Yeah. The bridge repair between Burnham and Spock continues apace, and they continue to apologize to each other for all of the shit that they've put each other through. And like what he says is, like, there are a lot of things that you need to figure out with your mom that don't even have anything to do with this whole saving the universe from control part of the project. But also, like, she has been, like, so laser focused on this one thing for such a long time. The fight against control that she has, like, a very specific set of tactics and strategy surrounding, that maybe in talking to her, you can kind of, like, see the problem from a new angle and figure it out in a new way. What do you think Gabrielle Burnham has been eating this entire time?
I mean, whatever roots and sticks exist on the Dagobah planet, I guess. Or, you know, if you have the ability to traverse time and space, you can go anywhere.
Yeah,
and eat anything,
so.
I guess.
Yeah.
She doesn't appear to be hungry inside the field.
No, she looks healthy.
Yeah. Sonia Sohn is so great in this episode also.
Boy, she is.
She's expressive and verbal in a way that we know her to be from The Wire. But one thing I didn't notice before that I definitely noticed in this episode was how much her posture affects her performance. Because she's given such a small area to move around in and act within.
Uh-huh.
And so few props to act with. Like, she's got the chair to sort of put her hands on to lean over. She's got so little to work off of. Mm-hmm. And it really made me notice, like, how she works working solo like that.
Yeah.
It made me appreciate her a lot more.
We had a brief little scene where Ash Tyler radios back to Contreland about how he was trying to steal the archive, but instead it didn't work because when Saru goes to push the reformat button, the archive, like, re-encrypts itself and locks itself down.
Contreland tries to, like, we are Section 31 Ash Tyler in this moment to, like, keep him moving forward.
He has limits.
Kind of a weird conversation to be having, like, in the hallway.
Yeah.
For anyone to hear. Because, like,
Ash
Tyler's
quarters,
just,
Ash.
He's just standing out there in the middle of it, like, a character goes by in a wheelchair. It's like,
you know what? He had been confined to quarters for so long. Maybe that's the last place he wants to be.
Maybe. But I feel like there are private places to be transmitting sinister information like this.
Like an old-timey airport has phone booth vestibules. Like he needs to find one of those.
I mean, he was really outraged by the idea of, like, going and doing espionage on a Federation ship when he got this job. So maybe he's also just like, all right, I'm just going to do a really bad job of espionage.
That's how I would do it. I would just be passive aggressive about it.
That's the American way.
Good idea, Contreland. I'm just going to drag my fucking feet.
Well, Adam, Pike agrees to let Michael go down and talk to her mom. And so go down and talk to her mom, she does.
This scene in the transporter room between Michael Burnham and Spock includes, I think, my favorite piece of dialogue on the show up to now. A lot of the show's dialogue, when it tries to make science or being smart cool, comes across as a little clangy to me. Like when Tilly says fuck yeah about science or whatever, like when people are congratulatory about their intelligence, that sometimes can rub me the wrong way. But Michael Burnham's Hamlet hell yeah was so cool and so, like, it was a cool person delivering a cool line about something smart, that I think that is That's the top of the mountain for me. If that's what you're trying to do, yeah, that's what you want every other line of dialogue to be when it talks about science and math and being smart. You want it to actually be this cool.
Time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite that I was born to set it right.
Hamlet. Hell yeah.
I mean, you are also just a well-known fan of the phrase "hell yeah."
That's true. Yeah, I use it all the time.
So the scene between Michael and her mom is great. Her mom is initially all biz, you know, like how's it going with wiping the hard drive is all she cares about. And when Michael Burnham like has bad news about that being a lot harder than anybody anticipated, and then is like, hey, what about the last 20 years? And like, dad, what's going on with him? How have you been? What's happening?
Between this scene and the scene with Dr. Burnham and Pike, we get a picture of a person for whom time has changed everything. Like, she has seen every Faces of Death tape hundreds of times. Like, Michael Burnham's life doesn't mean any more than Pike's life, which doesn't mean any more than anyone's life, because she's seen it all before thousands and thousands of times. Like, it's a level-setting technology that her time travel has done, and it has turned her into needs of the many person. Like, she embodies that as a person.
It's also an idea that we've been taught about by this show in the previous season. Like, the other Time Crystal episode,
right,
with Mud, illustrated this perfectly. All the different times Lorca gets, like, beamed into space or whatever.
Yeah.
So a great scene, you know, two, like, incredible actors just working at the height of their abilities.
Yeah.
You know, cry arguing and building toward connecting with each other despite the characters having very different needs in the scene. It's a fucking tour de force.
I don't know how physically you conjure tears that only rest on your lower eyelid before dropping.
I know.
Like, there's physical stuff happening here that I just don't know how they do it. And that's what makes a professional actor a professional. Like, these two actors are amazing.
It's like watching somebody walk up to the claw machine and just, like, drop the claw, pick up a stuffed animal and drop it in the hopper. Like it's not a challenge, you know? Like tears for me are the normal version of the claw machine. Like, the claw is dropping. Sometimes it moves an animal. Sometimes it picks it up. But when it hits the top of the box, the stuffed animal drops out. Like, I don't have any control over those things.
It's either, like, an ability, like how you're describing, or it's a feat of strength. Like, I just don't know. I don't know how you do it. It's great, regardless.
So time is running out, right?
It is the fire in which we burn, Ben.
And yeah, what Gabrielle is arguing is like, they're like, it's fucking relentless. Like, what we need to do is destroy the information from the sphere at some point in history so that future control can't get its hands on it. And
her message has been fairly consistent throughout. Let me the hell out of here. Destroy the information.
Right. And they have another McLaughlin group.
Issue two.
And Spock, in like some really classically written Spock dialogue, describes another way that they might try, which is instead of trying to destroy the sphere archive, just trying to put it outside the reach of control. So the idea that they come up with is take the thumb drive and put it in the Red Angel suit and then shoot the Red Angel suit so far in the future that there's no way control is ever going to get access to it.
The story logic makes this a possible outcome, but the longer I thought about the time travel logic of this, like, eventually time reaches more than 950 years into the future.
Right.
Like, should any part of control live that long, what is to stop it from gaining access to this, going back in time and destroying all sentient life in the galaxy? This is the difficulty in writing time travel stories. Like, they can always be beaten.
Yeah. The other factor that I was worried about that I thought was going to come up was that Gabrielle doesn't know anything about the signals, or won't admit that she doesn't, that she knows anything about the signals.
Right.
And that made me think that Control perhaps had its own time travel praxis that it was using somewhat imperfectly or whatever.
That moment was shot so differently from everything else that it really made you notice the message there.
Yeah. But then I just wonder, I mean, it does seem like the Red Angel showing up coincides with signals sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe somebody else uses the suit, and that can happen in the past and in the future and produce signals that Sonya Son's character wouldn't know about.
I could get with that theory. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like there's parallel activity happening here.
Like, it's either Michael or there's another suit somewhere, right?
Yeah. I don't believe Dr. Burnham in this scene. I just don't.
Oh. Wow. It does feel a little plot holy.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, just a side effect of time travel stories.
Right.
It's, I mean, like, I'm on the record as not being a huge fan of time travel in Star Trek.
So in addition to the sending of the suit more than 950 years into the future, there is the issue of keeping Dr. Burnham in the present. And to do that, they're going to modify a transporter with some of that dark matter that they shot out of the shuttle bay a couple episodes ago. They still have fragments of that to use for this purpose.
So their idea is they can send the suit into the future and break the thing that is pulling Gabrielle into the less distant future by using some kind of modified transporter pattern enhancers.
It's weird that her resistance to this plan is all mission based and not I don't want to be stuck in this time. Like, I've seen all time, and this is not my favorite time period. Yeah, exactly. She has a strong case if she chose to make one like that.
But I kind of liked it because I kind of get the feeling that she's just so fixated on her goal that she, it's not that she's working at cross purposes with anybody. It's just that she is has decided on what her goal is and how she is going to pursue it. And anything that is extraneous to that or doesn't quite fit within that seems like a useless distraction to her.
I wonder if that's how you have to be to keep from going insane.
Right.
Like, you must be narrow-minded in order to not let time travel break your intelligence.
Speaking of narrow-minded, there's a very interesting scene between Leland and Georgia where he is pitching her on taking over where Ash Tyler failed in the Steal the Archive project.
Mm-hmm.
And, I shouldn't have said Leland. I should have said Contreeland.
Right.
Because it's really Control making this pitch, but she doesn't know that yet. The pitch that he gives her is entirely based on motivating her with power. Like, he's basically saying to her, currently the Red Angel is the most powerful being in the universe, but you could go one above her on the leaderboard by taking her out.
Yeah, like an appeal to her vanity.
Yeah, which is, like, she seems like such a dangerous, chaotic character, and the idea that she has an Achilles heel like that, just like dangle a stake like this in front of her and she will take it 10 times out of 10.
Yeah.
Is pretty interesting, you know? Like, power is kind of her kryptonite. So she's given a device that she's supposed to take down. We saw another version of this device in Ash Tyler's hands in the in that Erase the Archive meeting. But she takes it down because they're going to start pumping the Red Angel suit with this information. And she goes down there suction cups this gizmo onto an equipment crate and then pushes a button on her wrist that cuts off all of the Simply Safe cameras back up to the Discovery so she can have a private conversation with Dr. Burnham.
it's fun to see Michelle Yeoh and Sonya Sohn in a scene together. Like, it just seems like a very unlikely pairing in a show or on a movie at all.
Yeah.
So it was a real pleasure to watch.
They're great with each other.
Yeah. They've got that mother versus mother vibe going in this conversation.
As an element of spycraft, this bugging device seems like a bad invention.
At least make it the color of the cargo container, right?
Yeah, and not have a bunch of like moving colorful lights on the front of it.
It's not good.
Super smart.
I've given you this black checker from this 80s era checkerboard box.
Yeah, so they kind of connect over the fact that they both really love Michael Burnham.
Mm-hmm.
Sonya's own character is very resigned to dying to complete this mission.
Yeah.
And Giorgio doesn't really see this as playing out that way. So.
When you've seen the death of trillions of people, it can't help but change your feelings about your own death, I bet, right?
Right. She's an incredibly nihilistic character in some ways.
In the course of this conversation, Dr. Burnham uses a statement that she's heard verbatim from Contreland earlier, and she's starting to put it together, Giorgio is, about what's actually going on that Section 31 ship.
Right, that Contreland is in fact Control,
yeah.
And Control isn't a perfect human impersonator yet.
Right.
So the use of the phrase unacceptable risk to the larger mission in reference to the Red Angel has been used twice in fairly rapid succession. Giorgio called out the weirdness of the phrase when Leland said it. So
yeah.
It was a little ham-fisted. I think you could have just done with the flashback to make this point, but...
lose the flashback too, man. I think that we don't need the flashback.
Wow.
Get it out of here. Get it out.
This conversation is kind of wrapping up as Michael Burnham and Stamets and Nan show up with the pattern enhancers. And they're like, oh, this is why all of our cameras stopped working. Fancy meeting you here.
What are all these checkers doing here?
And Giorgio like slinks off, but does not immediately beam back up to the Section 31 ship. She actually secretly contacts Ash Tyler and is like, hey, let's hatch an evil side plan. What do you say?
Ash is super game.
Yeah. But she also like, drop some threats on him if he betrays her, which is fun.
Yeah.
Gabrielle Burnham has been watching Star Trek Discovery from episode one, Adam. We get a series of flashbacks to all different times in Michael Burnham's life from across the series. And turns out she's been kind of keeping tabs on her daughter the entire time.
She uses this as like one final emotional cudgel to convince Michael to let her go and to do things the way that she's advocated for from the start.
Right.
Like it's nice. It's a nice emotional moment for them both, but it's still manipulative, right?
I wondered if they were going to try and like let her drop her guard here and become more of a mother figure. And I'm kind of glad that they didn't, you know, like it's, she's saying this in service of what her need is, which is to continue to fight Control by any means necessary. And she's like, she's kind of anti the idea of being saved from being lost in time. Like
yeah.
she's like, I don't want to shoot the suit into the future and just hope that works.
Right. Especially because they have one chance. And if that doesn't work, then they're stuck. Like the suit is the thing. The suit is the only thing that gives them options, and absent that, they have none.
She's got vomit on her sweater already, and she just doesn't want to. She doesn't want to miss her chance to blow.
Ash is able to turn off the data transfer, and then walks in on Contreland during, which is one thing you don't want to do at any point.
He gets beat up pretty bad. I would say that this is an uncharacteristically bad fight scene for Star Trek Discovery.
I don't know if I would describe it like that. It's rare to see such a brief ass kicking, like Ash is totally overmatched by Kentrelin, and Kentrelin like uses a piece of broken glass to stab him in the belly.
Yeah.
When you stab Ash in the gut, you better make sure you hit both guts. That's all I'm saying. Because I like his chances of survival, given that.
How many times in movie and television have we seen somebody like FaceTime up to say one crucial word?
Yeah.
I think that they're better than this. I think that Shahzad Latif is better than this performance. I think that the timing of it is not that great.
It also shows Kentrelin to not be smart, because he immediately beams down to the surface and doesn't finish the job of killing Ash Tyler, which you need to do.
All of that is a shame, because the next, the set piece of Kentrelin kicking everybody's ass on the surface is awesome.
Yeah.
It's like T-1000, like, you know, they're shooting him and the bullet holes are reforming.
Yeah.
It is...
He's got a John Woo amount of firepower down there, too. He's wielding two phasers and a rifle.
Yeah. And up on the bridge of the disco, they're realizing that this thing is going pear-shaped really quickly, because the sphere data is getting downloaded. It's going away much quicker now, and it's going on to the Section 31 ship, which is exactly what they don't want.
Kentrelin has also destroyed the control station and the time crystal inside the suit, which leaves them not a lot of options.
Right. The only thing they can hope for is that in letting Gabrielle Burnham go back to the time in the future to which she is tethered, that she'll at least survive this and they can try again in some other way at some point in the future.
Yeah.
So she goes back to Terralysium in the future? Is that what you understood?
I was confused by this too, TBH. Is she going to Dagobah, or is she going to Terralysium? Because if she's going into space, then she's been killed.
Yeah, because the suit goes before her by several seconds.
Yeah.
I was very concerned.
It's Michael Burnham's reaction that tells us that she survived the transit, right?
Yeah.
Even though we don't completely understand what's happened to Dr. Burnham or where she's gone. Like, I think if she was killed in this moment, Michael Burnham's reaction would have been different. I think she goes on to live wherever she is. We're unclear of that at this moment.
The only thing I was totally clear on in this scene was that giving Philippa Giorgio the task of fist fighting a cybernetic robot from the future was the right choice.
Why can't we give Giorgio a sword? She was so good with the sword in season one.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
I also just love that, like, fists and kicks have as much destructive power against this thing as phasers.
Yeah. Yeah, I dig it.
Leave the ass kicking to Giorgio.
Kentrelin does the hair pull splat down that you'd see in, like, a Street Fighter 2 game.
Yeah.
It's especially savage. Michelle Yeoh gets a ton of fighting to do on this show.
Yeah, they use her well.
Yeah.
Once Gabrielle is out of there safely, they all beam up, and the disco does photons by the dozen at the surface to try and take out Kentrelin, but he gets away.
And so does Ash Tyler, because when the Section 31 ship blows out, they're unable to pursue. What they have detected is the spinning escape pod of one Ash Tyler, which is slowly filling up with his blood.
Let's hope there's not a xenomorph in there with him.
Yeah. The button on the episode is Spock and Michael Burnham.
Yeah, and we've talked about you don't want to walk in on a sibling.
Yeah.
Michael Burnham has to scramble to turn off the video she was watching when Spock walks in.
Yeah.
But it seems like the bridge between them is now complete. He kind of returns the chess favor. It's like pragmatism. You know, he has shown her a tremendous amount of love over the course of this episode that... feels really good to see.
Yes,
it was so painful to watch them interact early on in the season.
Yeah, good ending. But was it a good episode, Ben?
I liked it. I liked the science-iness of it. I liked it in spite of some of the, in spite of the Swiss cheesiness of some of the time travel plot stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. What about you?
I really liked the episode in spite of a few things that didn't work for me. Like, I don't like the ongoing sidelining of Sylvia Tilly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're really punching bagging her in a way that I'm starting to, like, grow tired of. Like,
yeah.
I think she's more than what she's given for the last three episodes. I think in a larger sense, I'm wondering if it's a good idea to redeem Section 31, because by turning Ash and Georgiou into heroes of this story, you're transitioning Section 31 from, like, the morally bankrupt thing that should be destroyed, which is our position in the first episode of season two, was like, Section 31's no good. We need to eliminate it.
Right.
Like Admiral Bob said as much. But, like, the creation of Kentrelan gives Section 31 cover in a weird way, and it concentrates the enemy into a person instead of as a concept that Section 31 is.
Right.
And so by not questioning the necessity of Section 31 or its existence or what it says about Starfleet, like, mm-hmm. you're removing the more nuanced tension, like the questions that we should be asking as viewers, and replacing it with this, like, narrower, easier tension that like, it honestly doesn't make us work that hard to think about. And I think that lowest common denominator enemy making, I think, is unfortunate, because the show is so smart when it wants to be. And that's an oversimplification of Section 31 that I wish they weren't interested in doing, you know?
I think it's a fair criticism, and I imagine that it's tricky to deal with that tension when your hands are tied by, like, the continuity issue. Like,
yeah.
Section 31 has to exist in future versions of this universe. So, unless they, like, came up with a really compelling argument for it to continue to be a thing, like what is the good that Section 31 does as a, and like settling somewhere on that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think your point is well taken. Do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages?
That was going to be my next point.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first Priority One message is from the Friends of DeSoto, the pod, and Ben and Adam and Robs.
Wow. From us?
Yeah. And
from Robs?
And it's for Ben and Adam.
Oh. Very, it's almost as circular as the logic of a time travel episode.
Message goes like this. B for the Ben and Adam. We love to view. I for how incredible we feel about you. N for nerds who love to listen to your pod. T for the treasure times you mentioned. Big Rod. U is Uxbridge, the Who's Not Killer extraordinaire. R for Rob's, the greatest co-pod editor producer out there. O is overwhelming love for each episode. N is nothing better than a new download. Gah, I ran out of... Almost there.
Fine.
Bosom. You almost did it.
Adam, our next Priority One message is from your fans in slight embarrassment. Mm. And it's for Ben and Adam. Another one.
Nice.
Goes like this. You have made our lives better and richer with your podcasts. Through your dick and fart jokes, we made new friends, laughed with our spouses, or just enjoyed confounding people in general. We look forward to many more years of discovering Trek with you guys. Thanks for all the hard work.
Wow.
Just a nice letter from some nice viewers.
Sometimes, like, that's the best thing to hear, is just, like, people appreciate how hard this work is. And I think, to a degree, the help we get from someone like Rob and the help I get personally from someone like you can make this show seem easy to make sometimes, but it's not. So thanks to the fans in slight embarrassment for recognizing that. That's appreciated.
And the warm honeyed bosom.
Yeah.
Definitely. And all binturongs everywhere.
Definitely got to thank that booze.
Well, if you'd like to send a Priority One message, you know what to do. Head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message or $200 for a commercial message, and we really appreciate it.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
I did. I'm going to give it to Spock, because when they come up with the plan to save Burnham's mom and fix the problem, you know, three episodes from the end of the season, Spock, they just cut to Spock where he says, "I like science." And I was like, boy, like, when Schwarzenegger says something in a movie that is just for the trailer,
right?
I feel like they are now building stuff into this show that is just for the react gifs.
Yep.
Knock, knock.
Yeah. Man, I'm with you on that. That's cynical, but it's right.
Yeah, so he's my drunk Shimoda for that reason. How about you?
Do you think the first draft of that scene was science? Hell yeah.
Yes.
It's just a running joke between Spock and Michael.
Yeah. Yeah.
The hell yeahification of the things that they like.
Yeah.
Ben, I'm going to give my Shimoda to Spock also. Because there's a way that people demonstrate their intelligence that goes not like, you know, the doing of something with excellence or the teaching of someone else a thing that you know and they don't. Sometimes it's just a pronunciation that makes you look like a real shithead. And the way he pronounces that author's name.
Fourth century Earth philosopher Lao Tzu.
The 10 ways that I would pronounce T-Z-E are not the ways that Spock pronounces that in this episode. And it is so perfectly done.
Lao Tzu.
And so irritating.
Lao Tzu.
And such a flaunting.
Lao Tzu.
Of his intelligence. That that he's definitely my Shimoda. I fucking love that scene. They cut away from him saying it too, which
yeah, you can't
doing
read
it for
his
the
lips.
React. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Ankylosaur.
Like, I'm sure he's right. Yeah. I've never heard it pronounced that way.
Me neither.
The specificity of it leads me to believe that it's definitely correct.
Yeah. It's one of those moments that isn't intended to be funny, but I found very funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do we have coming up on the next episode?
Well, we saw a little bit, a little glimpse of the next episode and a bit of a vasectomy. We are headed to Borath. That's where Section 31 is headed, and Disco is on their tail. Looks like Ash Tyler is going to have to reveal this baby to everybody. And Michael Burnham is quoting Sarah Connor from the Terminator franchise.
Mm.
Future is not written, Adam.
Indeed. Only 3 episodes left in the season. Is that true?
That is true.
Wow.
But a lot of new Trek on the horizon, so I'm excited.
Wow.
Wow.
I'm excited too, Ben. Let's bring this episode and this season to a close.
Let's Well, let's bring the season to a close when it's time.
Oh, that would be premature to do right now, huh? I just exist out of time, Ben. I've already experienced the season finale. So have you.
One thing that I've been kind of starting to suspect I should probably do just to brush up is rewatch the Short Treks episodes, because I wondered a lot about the 950 years in the future timeline relative to the Michael Chabon episode.
Oh, was that the amount of time?
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, like, it seems like those were more connected to this season than they led on initially. So I kind of want to watch all four of them and just kind of have them top of mind anew.
That can't be a coincidence. Yeah, no. I think that would be smart. Smart way to spend an hour, I think.
Yeah, and a fun way to spend an hour, because those are, with, I think, one exception, pretty good.
Oh, I could think of another fun way to spend an hour.
What, jacking off?
Well, I guess I'd have to do it like 19 times to fill the hour. That would be a personal best, Ben.
Yeah.
As we throw it to Rob, let's find out what his personal best is.
The greatest discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast, hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Head on over to MaximumFun.org/donate to support the ongoing production of our show. And a nice free way to support the show is to head on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. All right, thanks. We'll see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.